Thank you, Cody. Good morning. I'm going to start in the seventh chapter of Romans today. Then I'm going to be with the 13th verse. Was then that which is good made death unto me? God forbid. But sin that it might appear sin, working death in me, by that which is good, that sin by the commandment might become exceeding sinful. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, soul under sin. For that which I do I allow not, for what I would, that do I not. But what I hate, that do I. Yet then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. Now then it is no more I do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. Y'all get that? That's Paul talking. Let's look at it in the Book of Mormon. Book of Mosiah, chapter 1, verse 119. For the natural man is an enemy to God, and has been from the fall of Adam, and will be forever and ever. But if he yieldeth to the enticings of the Holy Spirit, and putteth off the natural man, and becometh a saint through the atonement of Christ the Lord, and becometh as a child, submissive, meek, humble, patient, full of love, willing to submit to all things which the Lord seeth fit to inflict upon him, even as a child does submit to his father. Says the same thing. One was written back in biblical days, and this was taken off of the plates. Just one more little thing about how the Book of Mormon is plain and simple. I used to hear a saying a lot that I don't hear much anymore in this church. And that is, the Bible and the Book of Mormon are as two books as one in thine hand. And I believe that. I started off having to be proven of that, but now I really believe it. So what is it that makes us sinful? What did Christ say about us being sinful? Well, he didn't talk about you and me as such, but he sure gave it to the scribes and the Pharisees. And we all know what their reputation is amongst us here today. But how did they get that? And why did they get that? And how do we know what they did to get that? You know, you got to know the whys, and you got to have it explained to you. And there's a story that Brian McIndoe gave in a sermon a long time ago that really drove it home with me, and I've never forgotten it. Tony wanted a BB gun. So finally his dad caved in and bought him a little BB pistol, and they went out to shoot it the first time, and he gave it to Tony. And he told him, he says, now this is not a toy, this is something that you got to be careful with, and don't ever point the muzzle at anybody. Because if I ever catch you pointing the muzzle at anybody, I'm going to take it away from you. You got that? Tony says, yeah. Am I right? Yeah. So he turned around, I guess, to get the BBs. And when he turned back around, Tony had the muzzle pointed at him, looking at him. So Brian grabbed the gun and said, I thought I told you not to point the muzzle at anybody. And Tony says, well, Dad, what's a muzzle? There's a lot of things in the scriptures that what is a sin? What is this? What is that? And that little story has stuck with me because it's a lesson. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to read some in the 23rd chapter of Matthew, just to kind of give you an idea where I'm headed. Starting with the first verse, "Then Jesus spake to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore, whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But do not ye after their works, for they say and do not. For they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers." You understand what all that means? You know the functionality of what that says and what he's saying there? Or do we have to imagine it? How many times have we heard this? Numerous times. "But all their works they do to be seen of men, they make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments, and love the uppermost rooms at feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the markets, and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But be not ye called Rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all ye are brethren. And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your father which is in heaven." And it goes on down and talking about woe, you know, to the scribes and woe to the Pharisees for the behaviors and all of the things that they're doing wrong. Well, what were the things they were doing wrong? You know, I know we don't believe in drinking and smoking and chewing and having wild parties and all that kind of stuff. And I'm fairly convinced the Pharisees didn't either. So what made them so bad? What were they doing? You know, if you take a look at what created the Pharisees, it was their determination to follow the laws of God. That's where it started. Alexander the Great came in and conquered Israel, and I'm not going to go through a whole bunch of stuff there because it's pretty complicated. But the end result was that there was a movement within Israel to become Hellenistic or become Greek, because that's what Alexander the Great wanted the world to be, was to be a Greek society. And a lot of them were going that way. So there's a group of men decided, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to follow that and become Greeks, because we believe in God. So we're going to go back and we're going to do the things that we understand to be the laws of God, and we're going to start to obey those things, and that's what we're going to follow. That's how the Pharisees started. And being human beings, and human nature never changes, the more they started doing that, the more their neighbors kept saying, "What are you doing? You're going to get us all killed. You're going to end up in jail. What are you doing?" And then they started ostracizing them and staying away from them. That's where the name Pharisee came from, because in Hebrew, that's separated one. And being human beings, the more pressure they got, the more tunnel vision they got in what they were going to do. And that we still do that today. I saw a lot of it in my work. A lot of it. Well, Alexander the Great dies. His empire falls apart. His generals divvied up his kingdom, and it all came to naught because they didn't have anywhere near the capability that he did. So guess who won that in that era? The Pharisees. Because they stayed the course. They prevailed. And when they did that, they became the seat of religion. They became the foundation of the religion for those in Israel, because they saw their way through it and they succeeded. That's how the Pharisees started, about 100 years before Christ was born. Somewhere along in there. So what did they do with that? How did they go from being the saviors or the maintainers of the laws of God to what Jesus Christ called them there in the 23rd chapter of Matthew? How'd that work? What kind of a lesson do we, or should we get from that? I've got a Nelson Study Bible. And one of the things it has is a section called Between the Testaments. And it's a history of what went on from the last of Malachi to the first of Matthew, which is about 400 years. Let's see, 1776, 1876, 1976, 2076. See, we haven't been around 400 years yet. But this covers that era. And all of the things historically and religiously that went on. Part of it is divided into the different organizations, or the, you know, like the Maccabeans and the Herodians and the Sadducees and all of those, and the Pharisees. And it tells you what they did and how they came about and what happened to them. And I'm just going to read this. I'm just going to read this as what's in here about it. And being a cynic, I had to go look it up and see if it was true, and I found it in two or three different places on each one of these things. So I feel fairly comfortable in just reading it. This is not scripture. This is historical commentary. This is not scripture. Okay? I want you to be sure to understand that. A party bearing the name of Pharisee is first mentioned during the reign of John Hyrcanus, 134 to 104 B.C., and it's evident that even then there was an antagonism between the Orthodox Pharisees and the more open-minded Sadducees. Sadducees were, and I'm probably partially right and partially wrong on this, I get the impression that the Sadducees were a result of the Levitical priesthood, because they were the rich people. They were the aristocracy, and they were a closed society. And you couldn't join the Sadducees unless they invited you in. And that's not what the Pharisees did. The Pharisees pretty much dwelt on a common man, but they were very, very strict about following what they believed to be the laws of God. I would like to think that I am strict following the laws of God. But I'm a natural enemy to God. So I'll use my own emotions and my own reasoning and my own logic and my own ego, my own sense of pride. The word Pharisee means separated one, and the name probably meant in the first instance one who has separated himself from the corrupting influence of Hellenism and his zeal for the biblical law. Josephus says that the Pharisees appear more religious than others and seem to interpret the laws more accurately. Pharisees were punctilious in observing the laws regarding ceremonial purity. For this reason, they could not purchase items of food or drink from a sinner for fear of ceremonial defilement. Nor could a Pharisee eat in the house of a sinner, although he might entertain the sinner in his own home. Under such circumstances, the Pharisee would provide the sinner with clothes to wear. For the sinner's clothes might not be, or might be ceremonially impure. So I'm a Pharisee, and I'm going to invite Pat and Michelle over for supper. And they're not Pharisees. So the invitation's there, they accept, they come up, I meet them at the door, and I've got the ceremonial clothes for them. And I says, now before you come in my house, you have to take off those clothes you have, because those are impure and you've got to put these on. How would you feel? So Pat says, well, I don't think we can do that. These clothes are all right. So I say, well, then you can't come in. How would you like to be treated that way? Just to be ceremonial, just to be punctilious, I'll say that better, pure in my belief. with a sincere desire to make the law workable within the changing culture of the Greco-Roman world. And see, Hellenism was out the door and the Romans had taken over during this time period. It was the Romans that were in charge when Christ was born and Christ came. However, there was still a Hellenistic influence, I guess you say. Even before that, there was a Hellenistic influence with the children of Israel. The Pharisees developed a system of tradition which sought to apply the law to a variety of circumstances. This is books and books and books and books. During the first century before Christ, two influential Pharisaic teachers gave their names to two schools of legal thought. Hillel was the more moderate of the two, and Shammai was, on the other hand, was more strict. And he was the one that he bitterly opposed the power of Rome. He actually openly opposed the power of Rome, even though he was a Pharisee. And let me see. And his viewpoint ultimately found expression in the sect of the Zealots. And there was one of the, if I remember correctly, one of the apostles was a Zealot. He belonged to that sect of Zealots, whose resistance to the Romans brought on the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Tradition and Pharisaic thought began as a commentary on the law. And this is important, and it's kind of deep. This is important. This is what really struck me, because we tend to do this today. We did this in my work. We did this in every organization I ever had a exposure to. Tradition and Pharisaic thought began as a commentary on the law, but it was ultimately raised to the level of the law itself. You started off with something that was supposed to be a bolster or a plus or an asset to the gospel. And although it wasn't in the scriptures, custom and usage finally made it a law itself. To justify this teaching, it was maintained that the oral law, and this was a rationale for it, to justify this teaching, it was maintained that the oral law was given by God to Moses on Mount Sinai, along with a written law, or Torah. The ultimate in this development is reached when the Mishnah, which is another document, states that the oral law must be observed with greater stringency than the written law. In other words, by that time they had set the written law aside, set the laws of God aside, and started enforcing and practicing their oral law or their interpretation of what they thought it meant. That's dangerous. But we do that. That's part of our natural enemy to God problem. I know when I was working, we'd put out a memo for something. I don't care what it was. And they started following the memo. Within 2 months or 3 months, there was a little verbal alteration to it, because that fit things better this way. Then pretty soon there was another one. And a year would go by, you had to revisit that whole thing again. Because by the time it got down to a year and a half, it was not even identifiable to what it was originally. We all do that. And we tend to do it in our religion too, unless we understand what that is and the impact that it has, and that's one of our fallacies. I think one of the things that I've heard and listened to over time was how people take the scriptures and recite a passage to benefit them in an argument or something, or to prove a point that they want to prove. And it's really not quite right. I've done that. And I thought I was right. Until I went back and read it again and found out that I was getting off the path. And I had to change. Because my Bible and my Book of Mormon is better than my wisdom and my logic and my sense of self, because that's what it's for, is to go back and look at what it says and then do it. And there's nothing in the Old Testament. You know, when I was growing up, I was taught that the Old Testament was kind of my second choice. What I really had to do was to dwell on the gospel of Jesus Christ, which was the New Testament. And yeah, we had the Old Testament, and it was part of the things, you know, that you had to put up with because it was in the Bible. But you really had to pay attention to what it said in the New Testament. Because we don't do the Mosaic Law anymore. Well, what's the Mosaic Law? Well, the Mosaic Law changed from the time of the first five books of the Old Testament and by the time Jesus Christ came. The Mosaic Law was the rituals and ceremonies of the Pharisees. And it was called the Law. And that right there is what they did with the Law, what I just read. They adopted and adapted and changed it to fit the way that they thought it should be instead of going back and reading what was written. And that's where they got in trouble. That's why Pat couldn't come to my house because he didn't have on the right pair of clothes. And I'm sorry, Pat. And because of their success in overcoming Hellenism, this was the accepted way of doing things by the general public, by those who thought they were doing what God wanted them to. There was a lot of people out there that were honestly making a mistake, I guess you'd say, in their religion, because they were following man. And they weren't following the scripture. They didn't have them to read in the first place. It wasn't the Bible then. There was just a bunch of books that had been written, and they were all separate. The Bible didn't come into existence for. Well, it took the world 700 years to construct the Old Testament. And that wasn't done in a year. That wasn't done by a family. That wasn't done by a group. It was done by a series of generations of scholars. And one of the things that they always had to, one of the principles that they always had to meet was, is it right? Okay, what does is it right mean? I could probably ask that question and have everybody write it down out here and I'd have 20 different answers to what is it right means. This is right. And we can read it right, or we can read it not right. We can read it for what it says, or we can read it, interpret it for what we want it to say. And that's what they did. What does Roger Bruner do with this? Do I justify my actions? Do I justify my decisions by misquoting the things in the Bible to satisfy myself? You know, it becomes obvious when you do that because things quit working the way they're supposed to work. You have all these stories in the New and the Old Testament and in here about when they disobeyed God, things didn't work out right. And there was drought. Well, what causes a drought? Does God stand up and go abracadabra? No. But when the people disobey the climatological laws that God lays down, they create a drought. That's disobeying God. Did you know that back in biblical times that there was no desert in Israel or in the Mideast? There was no Sahara Desert? Where did the cedars of Lebanon come from? They cut down everything for firewood and for other uses. And when they cut down all the trees, the desertification took place. And they never attempted to fix it. And now we have desert there. And we have the Sahara Desert. And it's because of the actions of men back in biblical times from then till now. Disobeying a law of God. And everything that works Gravity is the law of God. Photosynthesis is the law of God. We don't invent anything. We just discover what God has already laid out. So how many of us do everything that God has laid out for us to do in this life? We don't chew, we don't drink, we don't smoke, we don't chase wild women at night in the bars. So we're Christians. You know, coming in here and sitting down on Sunday morning doesn't make you a Christian. Just like going into your garage and sitting down doesn't make you a car. There's other things you got to do. And you can't do them on your own wisdom and logic. And the first thing you have to do, the very first thing you have to do, is trust that God is right. Because He is. We have no idea of His creation. We're the speck. If you've been following what they found on the James Webb telescope and the Hubble telescope, man, we're nothing. We really are in the whole scheme of things. You know, for example, they've cataloged 1.2 million galaxies, not solar system, but 1.2 million galaxies so far. And they thought they had them all until the Hubble, they took, just out of curiosity, and they took a little bitty piece of space that was dark. They picked the darkest part of space they could find, and they put the Hubble telescope on it and gave it a multi-day exposure, and they found at least 70 more galaxies. So we don't have any idea. The one thing that I'm convinced of, that every time that we use our laws of physics, our laws of science, our laws of chemistry to explore out there, they work out there just like they work here, so that tells me that God made that too. God's right. And He made sure that we had these things, both of these books, for our behavior and our attitudes and our spirit and our souls. I read a passage here, sometime back here, about that people tend to worship the organization they belong to instead of the original reason for the organization. And everybody does that to one degree or other. Everybody on everything. It's not just here, it's not just us, and it's not just this church. And I'm not saying we really do that, because I don't think we do. I don't know of anybody here that worships our start, our organization, the organization of our church. But if you do, you're wasting your time. That's not what God gave us this building, these books, this information, all of the blessings that He gives us and the instructions that He gives us to continue to enjoy these blessings. That's not what He gave it all this to us to do. How do you worship God? You know, we're always talking about worshiping God. How do you worship God? You come up with a new saying every week? Can you sing louder and better than anybody else? Is your prayer longer and more eloquent? No. It even talks about some of that in the scriptures. How they make broad their phylacteries and the borders of their garments and all of that stuff. You take a 1 year old. A 1 year old boy, and he's looking at his dad. And it's part of the laws of God as far as I'm concerned, but that boy learns from watching his dad, and he admires his dad. The girl may admire her dad. Well, let's put it this way. The kid admires the parents. Let's put it that way. Okay. And the more they admire them, the more they try to do things like them. The things that they see them do and the things that they tell them to do, they do their best. Pretty much. to mimic what they learn or what they see. That's, they worship the ground they walk on. So how do you worship God? You want to do what he wants you to do, and you want to act to the best of your ability the way he wants you to act, to be a child of his. And the Pharisees didn't do that. They became their own entity. So did the Sadducees. And of course, those two made it the Sanhedrin, which is kind of like the Congress in this country, loosely. And they let it get away from them because it went to their heads. Because they were successful to begin with, they were successful. And that's one of the biggest dangers for us as human beings, is we get successful about something and we forget our humility. And we forget where we got those things that got us there. As a general rule, mankind, individuals or groups, achieve one great thing in their existence. I can't think of what his name is. I got an uncle five times removed. Sir William Van Horn, that's him. He was from Peoria, Illinois. He was a railroad man. Canada did a contract or whatever you want to call it on building a railroad from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and the government gave them 10 years to do it. And for the first two years of those 10 years, it squandered back on the East Coast. So by the time they really panicked, because they only had 8 years left in this thing and they had all this distance to go, they started looking for somebody down here in the U.S. that they thought that could get it done, and they picked this guy, William Van Horn. And he went up there, and in 8 years, he built the Canadian Pacific Railroad. He drove his employees crazy. And the only thing he wanted around him was people that were as enthused about it as he was. And he did it. So they made him a sir, whatever that means. He was knighted, I guess, by the Queen of England. So here's this guy with all these accomplishments. So the Philippines, they want a railroad, and they can't get it started. So, hey, let's get this Van Horn guy. We'll get him down here. He knows all about it. So he goes parading down there, and he failed. And it wasn't near as big a country because of his ego. So then Cuba wanted one. And this is a true story. This is true history. So Cuba hires him, and he fails again, because of his ego that he acquired doing something right the first time. And I put that kind of behavior path right here with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And that's the kind of stuff that we have to be aware of so we can stay away from it. And the only way that we can be aware of it and stay away from it is prayer. Do you ever hear a prayer? The prayer of a righteous man availeth much. There's a whole lot of caveats in there. The fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. So you got to ask for what's right to fit it in there. And we've got a God that hears all of these prayers. And I'm just going to say on this planet, which is how many thousand a minute, and can sort out what's right and what's wrong and grant the ones he needs to grant. And he never makes a mistake. And that's how big he is. And we think we know better. We think we're going to adapt and adopt because we're humans and we're naturally an enemy to God. Because we don't want to do things his way, we want to do things the way we think is best. And then it doesn't work. And then we wonder why, because we're Christians. I don't ever want to be a Pharisee. I don't ever want to be a Sadducee. I just want to be me, and I want to be a child of my Lord. And I want to understand what he expects of me, and I want to understand the signs. You know, I have it. We had a sign at work, whenever, and I had projects at work, man. I had projects at work. But anyway, the thing on starting a project and finishing a project was, where are you going? How are you going to get there? And what are you going to see along the way? And that might sound kind of facetious, but until you get into it and you start looking at what those words mean, where are we going? We all know where we want to go. We all know what we want to be, but how are you going to get there? The only way to get there is to follow Jesus Christ. And are we doing it right? Well, what are you going to see along the way? Is it working or is it not? And how do you get it to work? By going to what is right. What is right? There is no doubt in my mind that God caused these books to be, the information in these books to be preserved the way they are. There's no doubt in my mind. And all we got to do is, you read them, yeah, but you don't read them, you study them. You pick a subject and you study it, whether it's by yourself or in a group. That's what Sunday school class is for one. That's what study classes are for another. What do we do in them? Do we get in here and try to find out why, like in the King Josiah back in Kings, they had the house of the Lord. They'd had it for years. It was a nationwide institution. They had multiple houses of the Lord. And they had funds, and they had all of these workers, and they had all of these things going on. And they never knew that there was a book of the law. They didn't know they had what we would call today, back then was a book of the law, the Bible. And when they accidentally found it in a house of the Lord, the guy that found it gave it to the assistant, I'm going to call him, of Josiah. And he read it to the king, and the king went into mourning, I guess you'd say, because he realized that he had to change a whole bunch of stuff in the house of the Lord to put it in with the laws of God. And with the 23rd, it's the 23rd chapter of 2 Kings, the entire chapter is all of the things that they had to take out of the practices and the beliefs they had to take out of the house of the Lord. And we still do that. People still do that today. So you can go overboard like the Pharisees and then be so proud that you're religious, or you can be humble enough to know that you don't know everything. This group right here, there's tons of talent in this group, just right here, in this church right here, right now. There's tons of talent. There's tons of expertise. There's tons of experience. What do we do with it when it comes to things in these books? What do we do with it? Do we have social gatherings? I don't have a problem with social gathering, as long as it follows the instructions in here. And it achieves something that's in here. Be it a lesson learned, be it a blessing recognized, whatever. To Saul, later Paul the Apostle, the Pharisees represented the epitome of orthodoxy, because he was Saul was a Pharisee, the most straitest sect of our religion. As in Acts 26:5, Phariseeism began well. They had the right idea when they started it. They had the right reason to start it, and all of this. And its perversion is a constant reminder that self-complacency and spiritual pride are temptations to which you pious are particularly susceptible, and we're no different. Because we're human beings. We're human beings like they were back then. That part, technology's changed, of course. Human nature hadn't. So what do we do with our prayers? What do we do with our association with each other? How do we solve problems that we have here in the church? The biggest enemy we have to solving problems here in the church is our personalities and agendas. Our sense of self-worth, ego, pride. I don't ever want to be right just because I want to be right, to show people I'm right. I learned that a long time ago in my work. I learned the hard way in my work that my prayer every morning before as I was going to work was, Lord, help me do it right, not Lord, help me be right. Because there's a lot of times I had to back up and say I'm wrong. And then I had to do it in front of my subordinates. And I think because of that, I had their trust. And there's nothing if you don't have trust. There's nothing if you don't have trust for each other. I thank you for your time.